I'm writing a book right now with Brandon Cook. In fact, I've written a number of books with other people in the last couple of years. It's easier, and it's harder. It's easier in that they can do some of the work. It's harder in that you have to stick it together and make it work. But we're doing a book called Salvation by Discipleship Alone. Now, this is essentially just to get under people's skin and get them excited, the title. Because, frankly, what we really are saying is that if you, what we're saying is this little statement encapsulated a little bit by our brother Bonhoeffer. And that salvation's not a commodity, but an experience. That far as being a commodity, meaning salvation is not just a transaction. Like going to a store, you provide what you're supposed to, and then you get your commodity, you put it in the bag, and you walk away with it, and it's always yours. And that transaction, salvation, has been a transactional kind of commodity in the minds of people. Now, again, we're not talking about the spirit of the gospel. We're not talking about the intention of the gospel in the Bible. What we're talking about is how we as Americans have commodified just about everything. And the gospel has not escaped our grip. So, but Bonhoeffer said this: the only person who can be justified by grace alone is the person who has left all to follow Christ. Such a person knows that the call to discipleship is a gift of grace, that the call is inseparable from grace. So essentially, if you just ended the statement, the only person who can be justified by grace alone is a person who has left all to follow Christ, that would be very misleading as to what he meant and what I'm talking about. But what he's goes on to say is that the fullness of our salvation, the only way you really understand the fullness of your salvation and live out the abundant life of what salvation's meant to be, is by giving yourself fully to Christ. And especially if you've done it for a very long time, you are sure, I'm more sure today, that my salvation is a work of grace by God's grace. It cannot be understood or experienced inseparable from His grace. And that's the whole idea, a more holistic idea, a more robust idea. But I'd like to begin by talking about a story from one of the great books ever written. Now, a Russian novelist saved Russia for the gospel, especially during the period of time that it was a secular country, the Soviet Union. Dostoevsky. In his book, The Brothers Karamazov, if you like, or another, there's a whole numerous ways I've heard it pronounced, but I'm not going to give it a second go. So that book, War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, and Anna Karenina by Tolstoy, Crime and Punishment, and some other good works by, again, our brother Dostoevsky. Now, in his novel, The Brothers, as it's known in shorthand, there are two brothers. The first brother was Ivan. Ivan was the smart brother. He was the intellect. He was the atheist. And he was far too smart for Alyosha, his brother. He had ironclad, guaranteed to always work arguments. In fact, he kept headlines out of the newspaper, and it was supposed to be this life, this what the life is described as 1884, 1887, and there are actual headlines out of the newspapers in the city they lived in. And he would talk about the various things that had happened, the atrocities that had happened that people had done to one another, and that how grim life was. And he would catalog these things and prove over and over again in his arguments that if there was a God, that he was some kind of genocidal megalomaniac, that God himself was not a good person, if indeed God existed at all. And Elisha was not very good at arguing against his brother, but in the end, just so in case you don't want to read the whole book, in the end, Elisha wins because what Elisha had on his side was Christ. And so he wins in the end of the book with respect to the moral of the story. But there is a story that Ivan uses, and it's to prove or disprove the reality of God and Christ and so on. And it's the story called The Grand Inquisitor. And he tells a story about the Grand Inquisitor was the person in charge of the Inquisition in Seville, Spain, in the 1500s. And you might know that even though there were only 3,000 people that died in the Inquisition, if you were one of those 3,000, that's significant. But the story goes that in the 1500s in Seville, that Jesus suddenly and without announcement returns. And he is to be seen on the steps of the cathedral. And he's beginning to talk to people and then minister to them. And he's touching people and they're being healed. He's giving people hope. He's doing what Jesus does. And in fact, there was a case where there was a little child in a little white casket, and that child, people were weeping on the steps, and there Jesus raised the child up. And there was rejoicing. People were exuberant. And just about this time, the Grand Inquisitor is in he's a cardinal, and he's strolling or striding across the square, and he sees Jesus, and immediately he knows it's Jesus. So he does what any normal cardinal would do. He had Jesus arrested. So Jesus is arrested and he's placed in a dark cell underground. And for hours, he's just left down there. And finally, the inquisitor himself enters the cell with a torch. And he says to Jesus, "Is that you?" And then, "I know it's you." And Jesus doesn't answer. But then the Grand Inquisitor begins to tell Jesus, and this is a paraphrase, "It's taken us 1,500 years to change people's beliefs about you, that you left such a heavy burden on people, telling them things like the Sermon on the Mount, like they needed to turn the other cheek, that they needed to realize it's in their heart is where sin begins, that it's not just externals, but it's internal." And he went on and on like this, and he said, "We can't have you coming back," and because essentially he's saying, "We've lowered the bar of what it means to be a Christian, and now we can't have you come back and raise it again. And so you just need to go away. Tomorrow I'm going to proclaim you as a blasphemer and the people will believe it." Jesus doesn't say a word. He just walks over to the cardinal. He embraces him and kisses him on his thin, bloodless lips. And then the inquisitor just shudders. He takes his torch and he backs out of the dungeon and he leaves the door open because he knows closing it wouldn't really matter. Now, that story was supposed to prove to Elisha that the church is a fraud. But what it does teach us is human propensity to try to water down, dilute the real nature of what Scripture teaches. I think that what we have done is we have made it so easy to become a Christian that we've made it almost impossible for people to live it. We've made it, you don't have to get all that serious. Don't wear it on your sleeve. Don't be overwrought about the whole thing. Try to be classy. Don't get too serious. It's sort of just human nature. So I think our entire message now in the 20th century, in the 21st century, is pitched too low, but it's taken centuries to rip the heart out of the gospel. Now, if you've discovered, and maybe you have discovered, that the entire religious story that you're living in is based on a false premise, and that false premise is it might explain a lot of your reality. Someone a long time ago, let's say, told you that a profession of belief was belief. You see, we have confused the word faith with the word agree. In English, we've said, if you believe something, what do? In America, you sign off on it. You join a church, you get a doctrinal statement, you profess it, and then you sign something. It means, here, read our doctrinal statement. Do you agree with this doctrinal statement? Yes, I do. Okay, that's good enough for us. Now, I don't mean to imply that people are lying. What I'm really saying is that we've often thought of belief as agreement. Belief is more than agreement. I have my son and his son, my grandson, had an interesting conversation. My grandson was told by my son, I think it'd be a good idea, son, if you would clean your room. And my grandson said, Dad, I agree with you. And 3 hours later, nothing had happened. And my son said to him, hey, I told you to clean your room. No, Dad, you just told me you thought it was a good idea if I cleaned my room, and I agreed with you. He said, listen, James, I'm not trying to get you to agree with me. I'm trying to get you to obey me. So, agreement with religious doctrine is not unimportant, but it's not what makes you a Christian. Salvation was based on grace. There would be nothing you could do or for you to do. Your status would be never changed regardless of what you ever did. And what we're trying to say is biblical faith, saving faith, is what James talks about in the second chapter. And if you have a faith that is a saving faith, there is evidence that you have that faith, that it's real. In other words, another word you could use in English that would be equivalent to the ancient word for faith would be the word allegiance. We could say salvation by allegiance alone. And allegiance, not as, you see, I don't want to say faith is not mysterious. And I'm not saying that faith isn't supernatural. I'm not even saying that faith is not a gift of the Holy Spirit to us. What I am saying is that faith's primary property, if it is genuine, is to act. It cannot not act. Maybe that's the best way to say it. I think what James is saying is faith cannot not act. It must act. Its property is to act. It will always act. I suppose I mentioned this earlier, what Solzhenitsyn said, that only one person needs to stop lying to bring down an empire. And I think that what I would like to say about that, it could be that the entire salvation edifice needs to come tumbling down before we can rebuild it and start obeying Christ. You know, there seems to be a one of the reasons that discipleship programs don't reproduce. To me, the number one reason that discipleship programs in churches don't reproduce is that they are primarily about us. How am I doing? Am I getting closer to Jesus? How am I doing? What do you think? How am I doing? How's our church doing? Those are the questions we ask. And we're not, and the reason, and so because we're asking only that question, it's about us and how we're doing, that we don't reproduce, we don't get outside of ourselves, we don't start living for others, and we're following a leader, Jesus, who is all about living for others. Jesus was a man for others. Philippians 2, you can't read it, you know, without realizing it's about other people. He emptied himself. He laid aside his rights. And so I suppose the number one thing I suggest to people sometimes is quit trying to sort yourself out and obey. Don't try to figure yourself out. You're never going to figure yourself out. Now, this passage that I want us to look at, as far as the new normal today, I think that it's the kind of passage that we like to keep secret. What do I mean by that? It's the kind of passage that we like to protect new Christians from, or people that we're afraid are teetering on their commitment somehow. And so we say this passage really is a passage for the highly committed people. And I want to suggest that Jesus was the first person to teach salvation by discipleship alone. And I just want to say that this passage in Luke chapter 14, 25 through 35, which we're going to talk about here now. This passage, I just want you to think with me about it, is an evangelistic passage. This is not a deep dive discipleship passage, only for the highly committed. This is an evangelistic passage. And I think it's pretty simple to prove it. I mean, just look up here. A large crowd was following Jesus. Okay, now right there you have some very important words. A large crowd was following Jesus. Not a small elite crowd. Not just his disciples. A large crowd. He turned around and said to them, to the large crowd. So it's hard to escape this idea that this is something he said on the spur of the moment to a large group of people. This is sort of the over-the-shoulder teaching that Jesus did. You know, Jesus was the kind of person that he's going somewhere. He's always going somewhere, and somebody asks him a question. He turns around and says, well, let me tell you about that. That's what's going on here. This is one of the things about leadership. A leader needs to be going somewhere. It's so obvious that you go, duh. Well, yeah, but oftentimes, haven't you been a part of congregations that you didn't really know where they were going? Well, in this case, Jesus, he knew where he was going, and he was going somewhere, and he was leading. So, he says, if you want to be my disciple. Now, you have to understand that in the parlance or context of what is happening at this point, Jesus has not yet gone to the cross. He's not yet been crucified. He's not yet, of course, been buried and resurrected. So, but what he's saying is, if you want to be my disciple, in other words, that this is the only game in town, essentially. He didn't say if you want to become a Christian, because there was no such thing as Christians. So, and the word Christians only used three times and mostly derisively in Scripture. So he's saying, if you want to become my disciple, so if you wanted to translate this into our modern understanding of things, if you want to be my follower, you want to be my disciple, you want to be a Christian, you must hate everyone else by comparison. Your father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you cannot be my disciple. And if you do not carry your cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. So you cannot become my disciple without giving up everything you own. All right. This is why we don't like to talk about this one. And especially that this is what you lead with. Like with your neighbor, let's say. You going to lead with this? Well, you have more than one option as a Christian, what to lead with. But this is not, you know, this should be one of them. You know, this is an option. It's a live option. So there are a number of idols in our culture. And there's a lot to be said here, but some of these idols that we hold to, that we have to identify and put aside, are things like reason, science, consumption, tolerance, love, all these kinds of things. And I don't mean tolerance and love in the biblical sense. I mean the way that they're abused and misused in our culture. So let's just start with the... these three things that Jesus brings up. Now, there's lots of idols, but these are the three he brings up. And they transcend all of time and space and culture. So he says, first of all, you must hate your family in comparison to me. Now, one of the basic things about biblical interpretation is you know that he doesn't mean that you should just go out and hate your family. How do we know that? We know it because of his life. We know it because of his other teachings about loving other people. We know all of that. So you can't really say that Jesus didn't teach very powerfully and persuasively that we are to love one another as he's loved us. And we should honor our parents. All that. Take care of our wives. It's all there. So we know that's not what he means. So it must be hyperbole. We also know that it must be in comparison to something. And that's why the translators have tried to help us here with in comparison to. But why would he bring that up? I mean, of all the things he could bring up, why did he bring up family? Because the church is pro-family. I mean, this is what made the church stand out in the first three centuries was the way they treated their children. The church was for... It was against infanticide, it was against abortion, it was against abuse of women, it was against all kinds of things that were bad for people and families, especially women and children. And this is one of the real attractive aspects of the gospel, was the way that the church taught about the family. It made a big difference. So the church is pro-family. But it's also true that the family, while it's the basic unit of society, because it is so close-knit and so powerful in our lives. It also, when it's unhealthy, we can have unhealthy attachments to our family, and a family can have a pathological grip on us, because we also know that the family provides for us in our culture some of the worst things that happen to people. Not only the best things that can happen to people, but the worst things that can happen to people. And I don't have to catalog it for you, I don't believe. Because we know about these things, they're in front of us all the time through the media. So when we start thinking about that, there are certain habits and certain pathologies and problems, unhealthy relationships in the family. And let me just give you an example. This is not a deep dive into pathology. It's just a little bit of getting your feet wet. When I was first married to Jane, and we've been married now coming up on 50 years, and when we first were married, her mother didn't want to let us go into ministry. And her mother was really fighting us about it. And she said, "Bill, if you want to be a minister, you can be a Baptist minister right here in Grove. You don't have to move my daughter around and do all that kind of thing." Now, you know, she was well-meaning. She's just trying to keep us close by. I understand her motivation. We wanted to borrow $250. Now, on $250, we could get from Grove, Oklahoma to California and back, maybe. So this is 1969. She said, "No, I will not loan you the money." All right? And so I told her that, and I just told her, "Look, I know you love your daughter, but we are now husband and wife. We are a separate unit before God, and we are going to obey God. Period." And so her brother loaned us $250, and we left. We paid him back too, believe me. So, but you know, that's not a biggie, but. You know, maybe for some people, if my wife would have been somehow unhealthily attached to her mother, let's say, the whole thing could have blown up right there. And so sometimes you have to put God first, right? It's not you're not looking for ways you can diss your family. But sometimes you have to take that step. You know, you have to take a stand with your children sometimes. That's very painful. I'm sure many of us in this room, we could talk about that in some form or fashion. So what happened is Jesus goes along and he says to James and John, "Follow me and I will make you become fishers of men." And they're out there on the boat with Mr. Zebedee, you know, their dad. And so they drop their nets and they leave him there. With the workmen, it says. And later, Mrs. Zebedee, you know, mom, she came around and wanted some compensation. Because, you know, there are some theories that, and they're pretty good theories, that actually these young, James and John, were somehow distant relatives of Jesus. And that Mrs. Zebedee was a relative of Jesus' mother, something like that. I can't remember the exact details. But I remember the cousin's idea. And so essentially she felt like, well, if I'm going to lose the future of our business are their sons, and now they're going to go off and do something else, and now that leaves us, you know, holding the bag. Couldn't my boys at least have some special seats in heaven? And so that was one of the things that Jesus, and so his son, James and John, they went ahead and they left home to follow Jesus. On another occasion, remember when Jesus was teaching and somebody said, "Your mother and your brothers are here. This is in Matthew 12, 46 through 50. And in that passage, Jesus essentially says, who are my mother and my brothers? But those of who follow me. In John chapter 7, the first few verses, this is where Jesus' brothers said, look, you're getting a bit annoying. And we think you just ought to go to Jerusalem and become famous. That was sort of the shorthand. And Jesus says, well, you know, you guys, any time's right for you, but it's not time for me. And so there was conflict with Jesus' agenda and with his family. And obviously, so what happens is that there's not just families that are blood families, but there are families that are tribal. There are theological families. There are denominational families. There are societal families. There's all kinds of tribes and groups, and we can become those tribes, those groups, those families, those connections, those relationships, all can get in the way of obedience to Christ. Because we don't want to disappoint people. We don't want to get people mad at us. All those reasons. I can't go to that retreat. I can't go to church on that day. I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't follow through. Why? Well, then they go into the story. Okay, so that's the first thing. Family cannot control your life. The second is self cannot control your life. And we look at the passage here, and just to amplify it a little bit, you look back at Luke 9, and what he's saying in Luke 9, this is somewhat the same statement. It's not the same occurrence, but it's very much the same subject. He says in verse 23 of 9, if any of you wants to be my follower, you must turn from your selfish ways. Take up your cross daily and follow me. Put aside your selfish ways. And the cross is symbolic of that. The cross is not just symbolic of death and suffering. It is that. But it also becomes, in Jesus' way of explaining it, symbolic of your calling. You take up your cross because that's part of your calling. And you can't take up Jesus' cross. You can't take up one another's cross. You can't take up the cross of any other person on the planet but your own cross. The one unique in your life, your mission. Now, the original hearers of this would have been thinking of torture, a long agonizing death, hoisted upon a cross alongside a road. That's what they would have been thinking about. You know, the image in their minds would have been hundreds of people along roads crucified. So that's obviously about death. But he also says, you know, Paul said, I've been crucified with Christ, and it's no longer I who live, but it's Christ who lives in me. It's the new man. So the problem hasn't been that we don't love ourselves. It's more a lack of self-respect. And put aside selfish ways. This is something that is learned and learned in relationship to others. It's not quick and easy to put aside your selfish ways. It's accrued over time via inspiration and discipline provided by the Holy Spirit and worship and living in covenant with other people, reaching out to those around us, rearranging our schedules, changing your habits, making sacrifices, many of them small and seemingly meaningless, but they are not meaningless. So if we have, all of us have selfish ways, and we learn to sacrifice in small ways. And then those sacrifices, what they do is they build our character. They build who we are. And, you know, I was thinking about the whole sacrificial system was teaching people to give of themselves and to make those sacrifices and to make good choices. And I suppose, you know, Cain and Abel, remember when they sacrificed, and that Cain had a sacrifice that was not pleasing to God, Abel did, because it said Abel gave of the first fruits, the very best. And then Cain didn't. And that's why it didn't please God. But I suppose it would be, if it gave of your very best, have you ever thought of this? I mean, it's sort of a, kind of catches you off guard, but what if God said, you know, I want the very best? And so if an animal sacrifice, let's say you have a favorite dog, you know, or your pet, and so he says, I want you to sacrifice that dog out on the altar in the backyard. That kind of get close to home, wouldn't it? Now, of course, in my case, that would be, I could be for that. We have a little psycho dog named Annie, and I've often wondered if she was going to go through across the Rainbow Bridge. My wife came home once, and she says she was kind of teared up, and she had taken Annie to the Pomona, California Animal Hospital and Dental School. You know, there's a dental school. They got to learn how to do dental work, the veterinarians. And so she had all these dental problems, and it was going to cost like $3,000. And when she says, I think, man, she was really very distraught about the fact that we were going to have to put Annie down because we just can't spend $3,500 on dental work for a dog. And I tried to act like I was sad. But you know what? Annie's still with us. I said, well, how about some of those veterinarian students? You know, they could do it. And for $500, actually it was $370, they did all everything just because, you know, we gave them a dog to work on. That was a sacrifice I was happy to make. So the... I thought it was a good story for this time of day. Yeah, sorry. What time's this thing over, by the way? About now? Okay, we'll get this done. Okay. So, family can't control your life. Self cannot control your life, and another idol is wealth. And you go, ha, me? That's really funny. No, the book Factfulness, I read this recently. I actually listened to it when I was walking. But the book Factfulness by a Swedish researcher named Hans Rolling, who unfortunately died shortly before the book was actually published. But it's a brilliant book. It talks about, instead of, you know, it was a play on faithfulness, but it was factfulness. And the book's not a Christian book at all. But it's about how... things that you think are true aren't really true in the world. And so he talks about how people live on four levels. And we in the West, we live on level four. There's three other levels. There's extreme poverty, and then just somewhat poverty, and then whatever's just between level four and not so poor. But the point is, that we all are, by world standards, wealthy. We're all wealthy. And that he was talking about living on these different levels, and the fact that we have disposable income, and that we can have, maybe some of us in this room have stocks, we have investments, we have all those kinds of things. And so what Jesus is saying here is something quite radical. He says, now, give it away. Is that what he said? That's not what he said, by the way. He said, give up all you own. what he means. He has said, you have to put me before everything you own. But I don't think, based on other teachings in the New Testament, that it's saying, it doesn't mean give it all away. No, it means put it under my lordship. Because if we were to give it all away, it makes absolutely no sense. I mean, there's lots of people today who are funding all kinds of ministry, and they're doing it based on passive income from investments. So if you gave away your investments, you have nothing left to have passive income, either to live on or fund Christian work. But what he's really saying, I think, is he didn't say give it away. He said give up everything. And so he uses these three examples, Jesus does, is that if you want to be my disciple, then you first must put me before your family, me before yourself, and put aside your selfish ways. Gradually, it's going to be taking some time. And then also everything you own. Now, one last thing. In chapter 14, it says in verse 28, but don't begin until you count the cost. And he gives two examples, one of building a building or tower and finishing that building, or the second is about a king going to war. So he says in verse 33, so you cannot become my disciple without giving up everything you own. Now he finishes what he says, and this, he doesn't pull any punches here. Salt is good for seasoning. But if it loses its flavor, in other words, if the salt goes into the meat and it doesn't any longer preserve the meat or make it tasty, how do you make it salty again? Flavorless salt is neither good for the soil nor for the manure pile. It's thrown away. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. Understand what? That if you cannot be a follower of Christ without the priorities that Jesus points out to us. And this is true for everyone, not just a few, not just for the elite. This is for everyone. And because you know what is worse than no Christianity? Bad Christianity. That's worse. Does more harm. It's more evil. And what he's saying is that it stinks. It's putrid. It's terrible. In other words, and I would say, he who has a nose, take a whiff. We know what he's saying. Behold how it stinketh. We don't need that. We don't need the watered down, diluted, non-serious Christian faith. What we need is people who are truly, truly my disciples, because they will be salty. So, what we are needing to understand is how dangerous, diluted, a facsimile of Christianity is, and how powerful the real thing is. So he says, follow, learn, sacrifice. And learn from me. And what I tell people, and I'll close with this, is that the when I leave people with advice, when I'm on the airplane or in an elevator, and I try to give people maybe some final word, it's this. Follow Jesus, and he'll teach you everything you'll ever need to know. Follow Jesus, and he'll teach you everything you'll ever need to know. And that's what he's really telling us here. Follow me, and I'll make you into something. So I want to thank you for the privilege of being here today and to spend this time with you, to see the fruit of Richard Spann and his life and his wife and their work and labor in the gospel, and many of you as well. And so I've really enjoyed seeing God's goodness and faithfulness honored here. And I'm going to turn it back over to you, Dr. Spann. Come forward and close us out.